So tonight we're thinking about this topic of climate change, and I've entitled the talk Christianity and Climate Change, Exploring Science, Theology and the Church's Response. A bit about me, because you kind of want someone who knows what they're talking about doing this kind of talk. And I just want to say I'm not an expert in climate science. About the closest I get to science is a PhD in how birds stabilize their flight. Which is, just because you've done a PhD doesn't mean you know everything about science, just to clarify, for anyone who didn't know that. So I've done my best to basically understand this issue, and in terms of the theological side, I'm also a very amateur theologian. So I would encourage everyone, I put references throughout the slides, just to go and check out some of the things I'm saying for yourself, to make sure what I've said is true, both on the science and the theology side. And I want to focus on the science and the theology tonight, in terms of the talk, and probably less on the politics and some of the emotional sides of this issue. So, hands up, who can identify what these pictures are about? Anyone want to shout out one of them? Top. Extinction Rebellion, yeah, top right. Top left, easy. Yeah, bottom left. In the UK floods, yeah. And bottom right? Yeah, the Amazon burning over the summer. So, obviously, this issue of climate change and issues around climate are massive in the media at the moment. And hence, you guys know exactly where all these four pictures come from. And as Christians, we need to think about these things, understand what the truth is, and then work out, when people ask us, what do we think? Be able to give a coherent answer on that question. That actually glorifies God and doesn't make us look like idiots, because there are a lot of Christians around the world, I think, at the moment, who give a very poor response to this question. That doesn't do the gospel any favours. So does our response to climate change glorify God? So if we go to the next slide, what I want to talk about this evening are a series of questions. So what is climate change? I'm going to turn around because my eyesight's too bad. Is climate change bad? Is the climate changing? Why is the climate changing? What's the impact of climate change? How should Christians respond? How shouldn't Christians respond? What might we do practically? And then we'll have a Q&A opportunity. So, to start with, what is climate change? And when I need to find out a word, the first place I go is dictionary.com. Excellent website. So if we go to the next slide. So climate is the composite or generally prevailing weather conditions of a region, as temperature, air pressure, humidity, precipitation, sunshine, cloudiness, winds throughout the year. And here's the key bit about climate. It's averaged over a series of years. So it's the long-term trend in weather over decades. And if we go to the next slide, this is something people often get confused about. If you look at the cartoon, some guys there with their placard, Stop Global Warming, and they say, we've got to work on our timing, covered in snow. And then the guy on the ship, I've actually been moving upwards since we started sinking. And people often make this mistake with climate change, thinking, oh, this storm must be climate change, or, oh, it's freezing this winter, climate change must be rubbish. But actually, climate is about very long-term trends in the weather. Weather's very short-term. And while we're on the topic of weather, next slide, I just want to say weather is wonderful. I love it when there's a storm. Often in the UK, the storms aren't quite as bad as other places, but the Bible actually gives us this wonderful psalm where we can glorify God through the weather. When we see the thunder, we can think, wow, isn't God powerful? And when I think of this psalm, Psalm 29, this is, I think the best person to read this probably would be Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General. For those of you who don't know him, he's been quite prominent in Houses of Parliament recently. But he has this amazing, booming voice. So there's verses like, the God of glory thunders, the Lord thunders over mighty waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful, the voice of the Lord is majestic, the voice of the Lord breaks the cedars, the Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. And then the voice of the Lord strikes with flashes of lightning. So there's this amazing psalm talking about weather. It's a bit of a side point, but I thought I'd bring it out. There's this fantastic psalm. So weather is good, weather's wonderful, but climate and weather are different, so that's the main point. So next slide, is climate change bad? Well, that's actually quite a complicated question. The answer is it actually depends, because Earth's climate has always been changing. We often think of climate as being quite static and steady, but actually it's always been changing. And whether climate change is bad actually mostly depends on how fast it happens. So I've got this picture of a tortoise in a racing car, just to kind of illustrate that point. So if it's too fast, then that's not helpful for life and living organisms. Okay. Is the climate changing? That's the next slide. The very quick answer is yes, absolutely the climate's changing. And very, very, very few people would disagree with this. So this plot you can see here is from the Royal Society, a Royal Society report on climate change. And you can see on the bottom the year from 1850 through to present day. And the anomaly, so that's temperature relative to an average, so basically the change in temperature relative to an average taken over a number of years. And you can see quite clearly that since 1850 the temperature's risen by about 0.8 degrees Celsius. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but in terms of the pace of change, how fast the climate has changed, that's actually very, very fast. And this data, you'll notice there's three lines. This data is derived from three independent data sets based on thermometer records all over the Earth, and they're in agreement. So when you're a scientist, if you've got independent analysis or different measurements all agreeing, that's a very strong sign you've got good data. So we go to the next slide. This is a video from NASA showing the global surface temperature from thermometer data over the last 100 or so years. And obviously, when it's cold, when it's blue, it's cold, and when it's orange or red, it represents warmer conditions. And if you watch the years changing, we're in the 70s now, you'll see it very clearly is getting warmer over time. So there's that trend of warming. So very few people would dispute the fact that the climate is actually getting warmer overall. So if we go to the next slide. Why is the climate changing? So now we're going to take a step back and look at temperature records over the last 1,000 years. And these are obtained from multiple data sources. For example, you can drill ice cores in the Antarctic, and you can infer temperature from special measurements. I don't have time to go into now. But there are ways we know we can infer temperature from ice cores. You can look at tree rings, and you can look at coral there. So these are based on lots of independent approaches. So again, multiple data sets all telling you similar kind of story. And what you can see is the temperature goes down slightly. There's this thing called the mini ice age, which happened in the medieval period. And then from 1900 onwards, you see this massive sudden climb in temperature. So the question is, why that sudden rise at the end? This is a famous plot called the hockey stick graph, because basically it looks like a hockey stick, kind of a hockey stick on its side. Does that make sense? So why is the climate changing? Next slide. Well, there are natural ways in which the climate changes that we know about. And three of the main ones. Firstly is the sun and the Earth's orbit. So the Earth's orbit isn't perfectly circular. It actually changes between a perfectly circular orbit and a slightly squished orbit. And that has a strong effect on surface temperature and actually is the cause of ice ages. And that's called the Milankovitch cycle. Then there's also an 11-year cycle in which the sun's energy, basically it's the amount of heat it pumps out, basically varies over 11-year cycle. It goes up and down over 11-year cycles. Then there's volcanic eruptions. So if you basically eject loads of particles into the atmosphere, you can block the sunlight and actually help to cool the Earth. And that's happened in the past in Earth's history. And then there are large-scale weather events. You may have heard of these, El Niño and La Niña. And these are to do with ocean currents around the world, changing weather patterns. But what climate scientists would say is that actually none of these things explains that sudden rise, the bottom of the hockey stick that we saw in the previous slide. So if we go to the next slide, we can note now with this hockey stick that actually since the Industrial Revolution there's been a massive rise in carbon dioxide emissions. And so what we're effectively doing, if you look at the top right, that's like a very simple cartoon of the carbon cycle. So the sea basically breathes carbon dioxide in and out. And there's various reasons why that happens. And the numbers are in billions of tons of carbon dioxide. So the sea is basically breathing in over a year, say, 338 billion tons and releasing 332 billion tons of carbon dioxide. Again, trees, they suck in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and that helps them to build the plant tissues. But there's also a release from the land of carbon dioxide, 444 billion tons. And then we are adding 23 billion tons per year of carbon dioxide. So we're adding carbon dioxide into the cycle. And actually, we've increased the concentration of carbon dioxide from 280 parts per million to 400 parts per million since the Industrial Revolution. So we're adding carbon into the atmosphere that until now has just been buried in the ground in the form of oil, coal, whatever it might be, gas. But correlation on its own, just because you see two hockey sticks of carbon dioxide and temperature, doesn't necessarily mean that one thing causes the other. And there are examples where you can correlate two things that are completely unrelated. But in this case, we do know that carbon dioxide is what's known as a greenhouse gas. And we should be very glad about greenhouse gases. If there were no greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we'd all be frozen solid. Greenhouse gases keep us alive. And it's only that 280 parts in a million. So 280 of the air molecules out of a million are carbon dioxide. Those are what keep us from freezing to death. So we know carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. And to illustrate what greenhouse gases can do, if you go to the next slide, there's this kind of slightly quirky... Oh, no, sorry, not the next slide. So this is illustrating how it works. So essentially, the sun beats down on the Earth warms up, and then, like when you heat up anything, it radiates heat back again. And carbon dioxide molecules basically absorb that heat and then shed it back down onto the surface, just like a blanket. And you can see why this works. If we go to the next slide. So this is a quirky video that I found on YouTube that's quite useful, actually, from this guy. If we've got sound, that would be great. He's basically got two jars, one with air and one full of a greenhouse gas. Sounds quite low, I think, if you swipe it up a bit.
So let's switch to the infrared spectrum.
So he's just bought an infrared camera.
So here is the infrared spectrum. As you can see, the heat from my hand. And putting my hand on the table, you can see that it leaves a heat imprint. And so with the first glass, you can see that my hand behind, through the glass can't be seen. However, if I look through the plastic, all right, you can see my hand through the plastic
and
through the gas that's inside it. Okay? But other 5-inch container is filled with a global warming gas. As you can see, my hand is barely visible through the gas because the infrared wavelength isn't making it through that transparent gas. Transparent in the visible frequency, but in infrared, which is 200 times longer wavelength, cannot be seen.
So as you can see back in the visible light frequency spectrum, both containers are completely transparent. And the eye can see the red frequency of around 750 nanometers, the green at about 540 nanometers, blue about 450 nanometers.
Yeah, that's fine. You can stop it
now.
He's getting into the technicalities of wavelengths of radiation. So as you can see, these gases are totally invisible. You can't see them. But when you put an infrared camera, you can see how the greenhouse gas basically blocks the heat. It's just blue, so you can't see the heat coming through. So if we go to the next slide. Yeah, so to summarize, so why is the climate changing? There are these two hockey stick graphs, and we know carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so it does make the correlation does make sense. There are also lots of other reasons that I don't have time to explain because I'm already running behind, that point to the fact that climate change is caused by man and burning of fossil fuels, and I'd encourage you to look up that evidence for yourself. There is an awful lot more than what I've explained tonight. So what's the impact of climate change? One of the main ones is rising sea levels due to the melting of ice caps. So you can see there a NASA screenshot of Arctic ice. And on the right, you can see a plot. Sorry, it's quite hard to see the axes labels, but that's basically time on the x-axis and Arctic sea ice extent, so how much the sea ice grows every year. And you can see in just the last 100 years, it's suddenly basically plummeted down. So it's undeniable that the Arctic sea ice is retreating. And we think 1 degree of rise is not much, but it really is, especially over the period of time it's happened. Sea levels are rising. And what this is going to cause is more storm surges, more extreme weather. And it's also going to mean that as oceans are going to absorb some of the heat, and that will help cause more of the storms. And when we think about sea level rise, we need to be really clear that 40% of the world's population live within 100 kilometers of the coast. So what's the impact of climate change? Next slide. I've just touched on this, but extreme weather being more likely. Sorry, next slide. That's looking at sea level rise. Warmer seas mean stronger storms. Higher seas mean more storm surges. And then the next slide, what's the impact of climate change? Warmer seas, in the example of the Great Barrier Reef, mean coral bleaching. Coral just can't deal with the warmer sea that results from the fact that the sea is absorbing a lot of the warming that's going on. And so you can see a picture there of coral bleaching. One of the other issues with rising CO2 levels is the ocean becoming more acidic. So the CO2 basically dissolves in the water to make carbonic acids, and that makes it more difficult for marine creatures to form their shells. So there are various other knock-on effects. And obviously as climate changes, even life on land is finding it more difficult to adapt when you think of droughts as well. And then next slide, this is one of the more worrying things for scientists. What's the impact of climate change? Well, actually, more climate change. So there are these things called positive feedback loops. And if you look at the picture on the left, what that person is doing is actually digging a hole in the ice in the Arctic permafrost and releasing methane gas and lighting it. And methane gas, as you may know, is 23 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So the melting of the permafrost due to rising temperatures could then lead to the release of massive amount of more powerful greenhouse gas. And then on the right, you can see temperature and carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide's in the blue, temperature's in the right over the last 400,000 years. And the spikes, you can see the peaks of the ice ages. And actually, carbon dioxide slightly lags temperature rise. So as the temperature rises, it causes the sea to breathe out a whole lot of more carbon dioxide, which then contributes even further to global warming. So carbon dioxide and release from the sea has this kind of reinforcing effect. It amplifies any existing climate change. Okay, so next slide. How then? So that's a very brief surface level look at a lot of the key science aspects. How should Christians respond to this? We need to make sure we understand and respond to what the science is telling us with a Christian worldview. How does the biblical narrative help us make sense of climate change? So I'm going to consider this under three headings. One is we need to consider creation and this concept of stewardship, which some of you may have heard about. We need to consider the poor, and that's what I'm going to bracket justice as a concept. And we need to consider the good news, the gospel of Jesus. So if we think about these three things, we go to the first one on the next slide. So we need to think about climate change with consideration for creation. So with regard to this point, there's actually been a bit of controversy over some things people have written in the past about how Christians have responded to climate change and how actually the biblical worldview might have been a major cause of us exploiting the environment. So just to set the context for that, I'm going to read Genesis 1, which is a key text in this. So Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." And these words, rule over, subdue, have dominion, they have been perceived in some writings by a man called Lynn White in 1967 in a paper he released in the journal, the high-profile science journal Science, to be one of the cultural causes of this problem. So I'm going to quote from Lynn White now to explain why he says this. And it should lead us to question, what does dominion actually mean? So listen to Lynn White. It says, "Man named all the animals, thus establishing his dominance over them. God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation has had any purpose save man's purposes. And although man's body is made of clay," so that's God making man from the dust, "he is not simply part of nature. He is made in God's image. Especially in its Western form, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has ever seen." Anthropocentric means man-centered, centered around human beings. As early as the second century, the church fathers were insisting that God, when God shaped Adam, he was foreshadowing the image of the incarnate Christ, the second Adam. These are all things we're familiar with from church, aren't we? Man shares in great measure God's transcendence of nature. Christianity, in absolute contrast to ancient paganism and Asia's religions, except perhaps Zoroastrianism, not only established a dualism of man and nature, in other words, man and nature are very separate, but also insisted that it's God's will that man exploit nature for his proper ends. And that's the key. Lynn White saw Genesis 1, saw dominion, rule over, subdue, and thought, actually, no wonder. Man, Christianity has caused people to think that we can just use nature however we want for our own ends. And he goes on to explain kind of how this works. This is quite interesting, I think. At the level of the common people, this worked out in an interesting way. In antiquity, so in history, every tree, every spring, every stream, every hill had its own guardian spirit. This is kind of the pagan worldview, that every living thing has this guardian spirit. These spirits were accessible to men, but very unlike men. Centaurs, fauns, and mermaids show their ambivalence. Before one cut a tree, mined a mountain, or dammed a brook, it was important to placate the spirit in charge of that particular situation and keep it placated. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. In other words, he's saying, because the Christian worldview kind of gives this separateness between man and nature, and man is very central to the whole worldview, and because it made creation kind of something that doesn't have any more, a tree doesn't have a spirit that we have to respect anymore, it's just a tree we can use for our own ends, it's caused us to basically go and exploit creation. And that view maybe does seem to represent some groups of Christians around the world, sadly. But I actually don't think it's correct. You're probably thinking that's a good thing if I'm up here speaking in church. I think it's a bit of a skewed view of biblical theology. And I want to explain that now. Because this paper actually, when you read the literature, is actually at the center of the debate over whether, how Christians should really respond to this issue. And whether we're part of the cause of the problem. So into this debate came Francis Schaeffer in a book he wrote called Pollution and the Death of Man. So if we go to the next slide. Francis Schaeffer, who's heard of Francis Schaeffer? Yeah, good. If you haven't read Francis Schaeffer, he's definitely worth reading. So this view kind of explores Francis Schaeffer explored an answer to this guy, Lynn White. And he wrote, Christians of all people should not be the destroyers. We should treat nature with an overwhelming respect. And each thing in its own order, each thing the way he made it. The tree like a tree, the machine like a machine, the man like a man. In other words, creation belongs to God, so we should treat it with respect. And that's, you can see that right in Genesis 2. Right next to where Lynn White was kind of forming his argument. So if you look at Genesis 2:15, it talks about us tending the garden. The Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. So we are to take care of the garden. And actually, if you move then through the Bible, you don't just look at one part. You look at Psalms. Psalms are amazing in talking about creation. And on the next slide, I've put a series of references for those of you who like taking notes. But just to give an example, Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it, for he founded it on the seas and established it on the water. So if the earth belongs to God, why would we go and exploit it and trash it? And look at Psalm 65, for example, which I've got on the screen, which talks about God's care for creation. You care for the land and water it. You enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water. You provide the people with grain, for so you have ordained it. You drench its furrows and level its ridges. You soften it with showers and bless its crops. You crown the year of your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the wilderness overflow. The hills are clothed with gladness. The meadows are covered with flocks, and the valleys are mantled with grain. They shout for joy and sing. And many of the Psalms speak of God, creation belonging to God, God rejoicing in his creation. We heard that this morning, didn't we, with Psalm 104. And so the first part of the Christian answer to this kind of very skewed view, in my opinion, is creation is sacred because it's made by God. And it's given by God, and it ultimately will always belong to God, even though he's given it to us to use and enjoy. Secondly, so my three points, consider creation, stewardship. Secondly, we should consider the poor. So we go to the next slide. It's impossible to read the Old Testament without noticing God's deep concern for social justice and the redistribution of wealth. And I won't go through it all, but Leviticus 19 is a good example. And that's where you get the famous, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. And then there's Deuteronomy 15, Leviticus 25. You can read about the sabbatical years, the Jubilee years. This is where people's debts would be basically cancelled if they're in debt, to make sure we lived in a debt-free world. And then if we go to the next slide. So one of the big ways we respond to climate change as Christians is with love. Because ultimately this issue is about the consumption of resources by the wealthy leading to suffering for the poor. So we need to think about this issue very much in terms of love for people. So that's very important. So consider creation, consider the poor, in terms of how we use resources, what we're doing to the world. And then finally, we need to consider the gospel. We need to consider Jesus. And this actually is where the Christian response to global warming and climate change is very different from the secular world. And we need to be careful and make sure we articulate this right. So we believe that God is in charge of future events. God is sovereign over history. It's not random chance. It's not all down to us to save the planet and save the human race from extinction. This is not the narrative of the Bible. So we reject atheistic, humanistic notions, ideas that the human race will go extinct, or that through getting our act together, putting loads of solar panels in the ground, we can build utopia here on Earth and live happily ever after. This is not true. The good news of the gospel is that in the midst of seeming chaos, Jesus is king and will one day put right the mess that we've made. Our dominion, though that's not the intention in Genesis 1, it has been greedy, exploitative, and unjust in many ways. But contrast this, and I want to go now to Daniel 7. So contrast our dominion, greedy, exploitative dominion of human sin, with Daniel 7. In Daniel 7, it's really amazing language. You see these great beasts, and they represent the big empires and civilizations of the world, the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. Big civilizations, big powerful entities. And one day God will come into this final civilization, whatever form it will be, and he will bring judgment. So in Daniel 7:13, Daniel says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days," that's God the Father, "and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples and every language worshipped him. His dominion," there's that word, "is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." So Christ will show us what the dominion of Genesis 1 should have looked like. A dominion of love, justice, of peace, and joy. And it's a dominion in some mysterious sense. Because in some mysterious sense, creation looks forward to this judgment of Christ, given its current mistreatment. So we go to the next slide. You look at Romans 8, verse 19 to 21. Paul says, "For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration," that's the fall in Genesis, "our sin, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and the glory of the children of God." And that's when Jesus returns. So salvation isn't about us. Often in conservative evangelical circles, we make it all about us and sin and we need to go to heaven and what Jesus has done. But the gospel is bigger than that. It's about all of creation being liberated from bondage to decay, including our sin, but also the whole of creation. And we look forward to a new heaven and a new earth where Jesus is king. So to summarize then, science does show, I think, that climate change is real, that it's caused by people. The Bible does not advocate exploitation of creation based on Genesis 1. A bigger picture of all of biblical theology, it's just nonsense to say things like that. We need to care for creation. We need to consider the poor. But we don't also believe that we'll go extinct. We believe Jesus is coming again to make a new heaven and a new earth. And we can trust him. How shouldn't Christians respond? Next slide. So there's some kind of classic responses you might hear that I've kind of thought about. Well, Jesus is coming to destroy the earth. Thinking of 2 Peter 3, which does talk about destruction of creation at the end. So why bother to look after the earth if that's happening? Well, there's a couple of things. Atheists have this problem too, because they believe one day the sun will swallow up the earth and destroy us all. So it's a problem both kind of secular and Christian people actually have. But I would say we don't know when Jesus is coming. And if he came in 400 years, let's say, and by that time climate change has caused massive suffering for millions of people because we haven't bothered to do anything, then that's surely not loving of us. So that would be one way you could think about that. So I don't think that's a good argument for not caring for creation, actually doing something about the problem that we have. God is in control, so we shouldn't worry about climate change. And sometimes Christians quote seed time and harvest, so Genesis 8:22, where God promises these things will always go on. And absolutely, that promise is true. The seasons are mainly influenced by the Earth's tilt and orbit around the Earth. I don't think climate change will affect it to that extent. But it does mean that still millions and millions of people can suffer terribly as a result of climate change. So I still don't think that's a good argument. We still have human responsibility to act in obedience to God with justice for the poor. There are, if you look at YouTube, you'll find people who say climate change is a hoax. It's just a thing to push a left-wing agenda. There are, and I want to say, there are intelligent scientists who, you know, work professionally, who do believe that. But they are in a massive minority. We should never hold science to the same level of authority as the Bible. But science is generally a good source of truth, I would want to say. And the gospel is more important. This is quite a subtle one. Obviously, the gospel is the most important thing to us as Christians, the thing we value most, and that's right. But to kind of ignore climate change and just say, focus on the gospel, well, you're kind of denying the gospel by doing that. So that doesn't, it's not really going to make much sense to people. If you say, I love Jesus, I think we should all care for creation because it belongs to God. But we need to make sure people hear the gospel, so I'm not going to bother with that. Actually, our proclamation of the gospel should be included in how we care for creation. So the things should all be merged into one whole approach to life that people can see and be attracted to and see what the difference that Jesus makes. So finally, thanks for being patient. What can we do practically? I put a few ideas. There's so many things. Just a few ideas. One of the things I try and promote the most is just explore 100% green energy tariff, because actually it might not cost you any more and you can make a huge difference by immediately switching to that, to your own carbon footprint. You could give to carbon offset schemes. It's around less than £200 a year to offset your 13 tons of carbon dioxide that the average UK person produces. Consider your political influence. This should be an important issue when we vote. It's not the only issue, but it is an important one. Use your consumer vote wisely. What do I mean by consumer vote? Every time you spend money, you're essentially approving of something. And maybe your consumer vote is even more powerful than your political vote. I'm not saying everyone should agree with that, but that might be the case. So think about how you spend your money, because every time you buy something, you're approving of it. And you're encouraging more of it. So think about how you spend your money. Use your influence at work and society. Flying, if you fly a lot, is a big one. This is difficult for me because I have to fly a lot for work. David Attenborough, it's a difficult one as well because people ask him about it.